You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
This is Amicus, a lot of you on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. As always, my producer Max and I are delighted and we are honored that you have chosen to spend some time in discussion and exploration with us of some of those major events in the areas of rule of law administration, the operation of government, and the delivery of justice in America and beyond. My name is Jim Santel. I'm your host for this reincarnated and restyled version of our program, again, Amicus, a Law Review. You may recall well that a couple of weeks ago, we concluded our sessions, our live broadcasts on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. And we are now returning to Civic Media, continuing this wonderful affiliation to provide you with information, perspective, understanding, and other information that may be helpful to you in understanding some of the major civics and government news events of our week. This is a podcast format, which means that you can access it as you would like during the course of your days and weeks and weekends. And I'm delighted, as always, again, to be affiliated with Civic Media in bringing this to you. While it means that we will not be having call-in listener comments and questions, those are always very much welcome through Civic Media, and we can respond to those in future podcasts as well. Our format will be just that, and we're going to be a little bit more abbreviated than we normally are, which is about a 40 or 42 minute podcast session. Looking forward to that, but also, as always, bringing you the same content, the same substance, the same insight into all of these various issues. We are going to be posting at least one, if not more, of these podcasts every single week. And also as a part of our newly expanded and reincarnated version of Amicus, a Law Review, also providing you with some more limited, several minute, 2 minute, 3 minute, 4 minute, 5 minute sessions as the news of the days and our weeks so dictate. And so once again, delighted to be back with you through Civic Media and coming back into your homes, your businesses, talking about all of these important issues. Let's go back and reaffirm where we get our name, which is Amicus, a Law Review. We have spoken about this on routine occasions in the past. And so many of you, if not all of you, certainly those of you who have been with us during the live broadcast, recall that an amicus is a friend, an individual, an organization that is not a party to a legal case, but who is permitted by a court, by a tribunal of some court, to assist that court, that decider of facts, that renderer of judgments, to offer some information, some expertise, some insights, some perspective that is a bearing on the issues in the case. And so the phrase, while it's legal and it's Latin in nature, the origin itself goes way back to 1605 or 1615, the early trappings of what we think about as our Anglo-American legal system. We take our name in this broadcast, from exactly that, attempting for the community to be your friend, not in terms of the way that you may be friends with your neighbor or others in your community, but friends to provide that information and insight perspective that can help you form your own opinions and perspectives, and also ask more questions about what is going on, specifically, once again, in the areas of rule of law, administration of justice, and the operation of government. It is significant that way back at the start of this concept of amicus in the law, Lord Justice of Appeal, a fellow named Cyril Salmon, said in a case called Allen versus Sir Alfred McAlpine and Sons, he said, "I've always understood that the role of an amicus is to help the court, help the community, help the people by expounding the law impartially, or if one of the parties was unrepresented, by advancing the legal arguments on his behalf." That, once again, on behalf of Cyril Salmon and his commission, at the time that this concept was first a part of our system, that is also what we are adopting here at Civic Media as a part of our service and your support, our education, and specifically our continuing engagement with you. Thus it is that our broadcast, our podcast, continues as Amicus and a Law Review, and also continuing with our commission to bring you these important issues in the area of law and government and the administration of justice. Our content remains the same, our format somewhat different, and even enabling us, as I indicated, to do more things responsive to what happens during the course of any particular week. We so look forward to your continuation of the relationship between you, your family, your friends, your colleagues, and civic media as we continue to go down this important route and this important mission on your behalf of providing amicus information, friend of the court, friend of the community, as a part of our mission. We know that just this past week, the United States Supreme Court concluded its very important, significant term of the 2025-2026 term of its review of cases, and most recently, its administration of the law by issuing a number of opinions, almost 60 altogether. And in this newly constituted format, we're going to begin by announcing a series of podcasts in which we're going to examine some of the major cases that were in fact issued, decided by the Supreme Court in recent weeks and recent months. You know from our previous live broadcast that we covered some of those. Those included the major decision having to do with tariffs in America and also the Voting Rights Act case. But there have been many others. Why? Because the Supreme Court now has issued no less than 59 or 60 cases. We're not going to be able to address all of those, but beginning with this podcast in particular, we're going to be reviewing about 18 of them in the next several podcasts over the month of July and perhaps into August as well, that really do affect our lives and our livelihoods here in the United States of America, and specifically here in the state of Wisconsin. We're also, as I said, going to be responding to any breaking and current rule of law events of the days, of our weeks, and those will not only be a part of our podcast, but also these special, smaller inserts into the civic media broadcasts of the week. And so let's begin by talking a bit about some big takeaways from this past term of the United States Supreme Court. And then we'll talk about a couple of cases, much related, that have also been the subject of a lot of anticipation in recent weeks. We know, among other things, about some of the big trends that come out of these major 60 cases or so. The court undeniably has further expanded presidential power, executive authority, and it has done so in a series of cases that go back two terms and continue into this term. The justices were willing to put some limits on the presidential authority, including this particular president. But the court's six-member majority of basically Republican nominees, both recent and past, basically delivered a long sought after series of wins for the legal movement that would view a greater authority vested in the presidency. The court expanded executive power by allowing this president and future presidents as well the capacity, the power to fire leaders of independent agencies for any reason or no reason at all. And we're going to talk more about that in just a few moments or so. That major decision, along with a companion decision that was issued just this past week, overturned, yes, a 90-year precedent that allowed Congress to protect those kinds of regulators from at-will removal, and so to insulate these independent agencies from political pressure. Ahead of the midterm elections, the majority of the Supreme Court also significantly narrowed, as I indicated, the Voting Rights Act. That is no small thing. We're going to be talking more about that in future podcasts as well. It does make some members of our political community throughout the nation, gives them the capacity, makes them able to redraw congressional maps and dismantle some majority black districts. We have seen that around the country in several states, even to this date. And a pair of decisions decided once again on a 6-3 down the partisan divide vote. The court also allowed the president and any future presidents to move forward on plans to expel hundreds of thousands of migrants from this country and to turn away others who are seeking asylum at our southern Mexican border. Now, in the midst of all of those kinds of things, many, many cases, including those top-level things the Supreme Court decided, the justices also, from my perspective, picked some key moments to push back on some of this president's signature policies. We know as well, based upon the headlines, that an ideological diverse portion of the justices of the Supreme Court invalidated, said these things are wrong. The president's sweeping Paris policy, a huge decision with which the president, of course, did not concur. And also with respect to international commerce, a huge decision affecting our economy and the economy of the world. In the final weeks of this term, they also, that is a majority of the Supreme Court, also rejected the president's attempt to end birthright citizenship for babies born to undocumented immigrants and temporary foreign residents, effectively rejecting what the president had said on his first day in office way back in January of last year. And the court also blocked this president from immediately firing a commissioner of the Federal Reserve. Her name is Lisa Cook. We'll talk about that more in just a few moments.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
So we've got this balance, if you will, of the Supreme Court giving the presidency, not just this president, but future presidents as well, a great deal more authority. And that's a huge, huge change in the way that government operates based upon this authority being given to the White House, but also in some important ways did push back on some of that. We'll talk about more of those things in both directions in this broadcast, in this podcast, and also in the future. It is fair to say that along the way, as the president has indicated, that some of his own appointees disappointed him, and he did some name-calling along the way. He identified Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, again, the three nominees and appointees to the Supreme Court during the course of his term. They often supplied some crucial votes to reject some of these presidential initiatives and some of the president's executive orders, and they joined some coalitions of the so-called liberal side of the court that included sometimes the Chief Justice and others on the court. Trump has over the years criticized some of these members of the Supreme Court, including his own nominees, and described them from time to time as being disloyal. Justice Amy Coney Barrett, among others, has been a particular target of some of that criticism, along with others with whom the president has been disappointed. Amy Coney Barrett wrote that majority opinion, a 5-4 decision, among others, a decisive vote that allowed some mailed-in ballots to be counted after Election Day. We'll talk about that down the road as well. And she also joined Chief Justice John Roberts' majority opinion sustaining birthright citizenship on constitutional grounds. Again, that was an initiative that the president very much wanted to overturn and tried to do that during the course of his recent term in office. After Justices Barrett and Gorsuch voted to reject the tariffs initiative, his work in that area, the president called them fools and lapdogs, an embarrassment to their families. And so one of the other big takeaways is that this president has identified these members of the Supreme Court and others, certainly, including the three so-called liberals, as being contrary to his interests. And certainly they have been when it comes to making decisions with the president has not concurred. Some other big trends we pull away from this Supreme Court. Gun rights. The Supreme Court has issued two major Second Amendment cases, and then also LGBTQIA protections, the waning of those during the course of this term. With respect to the first of those, the Second Amendment issues, the Supreme Court ruled that the federal government cannot disarm a gun owner who has an occasional use of marijuana, described the fact that, yes, indeed, others who might be habitual drug users can be prohibited from using and possessing weapons. But in this particular case said, nope, you can't prohibit this particular marijuana user from holding a weapon. And also said that the state of Hawaii, and presumably others as well, cannot require people carrying guns to have explicit permission from the owners of private properties that is otherwise open to the public. So think about gas stations and shopping malls, things like that. Significantly, though, in that case, does not prevent the private property owners from posting on their doors, on their windows, prohibitions about the carrying of weapons into those private but public invited properties, but simply that the people carrying those guns do not have to solicit the explicit permission of those owners before entering those properties. So two major gun cases. Also significant to note that the Supreme Court has also already indicated that it is, as a part of its inhabiting and already stocking the coming docket of the 2026-2027 docket, has already indicated it's going to weigh the constitutionality of some laws protecting AR-15 rifles, automatic rifles in America, a huge case coming up in the guns area again next term. We'll talk about all that in a future podcast as well. In cases on gay and transgender rights, the Supreme Court has in this past term handed what are called conservatives in America when it comes to those issues some big wins. They ruled that Colorado's ban, like bans including that in Wisconsin and other places around the country on so-called conversion therapy, which again is a disregarded and dispute and disassociated from the medical community, attempt to change a minor's gender identity or sexual orientation through therapies, largely discredited in the medical community. They said that Colorado's ban on that through a particular statute violated a First Amendment right of a particular person there practicing in this area to engage in free speech. It became a First Amendment case, but also, again, an LGBTQIA matter. And they also said that states are free to bar transgender females from competing in girls' and women's school sports. Another big LGBT case did not compel that, but said that legislatures can, in their discretion, if they choose to do so, can pass legislation that bars transgender female athletes from competing in girls' and women's sports. Big cases in the areas of guns and also LGBT protections of this past term. And finally, just generally, an observation about the Chief Justice. Based upon my review of the Supreme Court cases, including how the particular justices voted in concurrences, in dissents, in majority opinions, minority opinions, it appears that Chief Justice Roberts, once again, shows that he is in some version of control of the court when it comes to the ways in which the Supreme Court is deciding these major cases. It is notable that he voted in the majority more often than any of his colleagues in this past term, and he wrote the majority in nearly every single one of the majority cases this term, including most recently that big decision blocking the president's birthright citizenship order, and also that previous order in which the president had attempted to impose these sweeping tariffs. Supreme Court saying, nope, that is unconstitutional. Only the Congress can do that. In those cases, not only the Chief Justice leading the way in terms of articulating what that particular standard would be in each of those cases and how they should be resolved, but also apparently able to assemble some ideologically diverse coalitions with, yes, some conservative, but also some liberal justices on the Supreme Court. And that included, as I just indicated, some of those who are also a part of the president's nominee group from his first term in office. So those are some big trends that I pull from the Supreme Court in its present continuing term. Note that the next term, the 2026-2027 term, does not begin for a number of months yet. October 1 is when it will begin to hear new cases, including presumably that guns cases and many others that will also be the subject of the Supreme Court's decisions, including oral arguments and brief writing, brief solicitation, including amicus briefs that may be filed by parties who want to provide information to the court that may not otherwise be available to it. All of that coming up again in the coming term of the United States Supreme Court. They are not going out of business. We will hear more from them during the course of the summer months and early fall months. But their major decisions of this past term are now concluded. And again, just about 60 decisions, much available for you to review both online and in other venues. Go to your library and check those out as well. You can go onto the Supreme Court website and pull down excerpts of and the complete opinions, and some of them are very lengthy in all of these areas. You can also still hear the oral arguments virtually for all of these cases that the Chief Justice has posted on the Supreme Court website. You can hear the Supreme Court justices engaging questions back and forth with the litigants and their attorneys who are petitioning for various forms of relief orally in front of the Supreme Court. All that's available to you in addition to, again, on a weekly basis, being a part of our process here as a part of our amicus mission to provide you with information and background and perspective that helps you to understand not only the Supreme Court, but the world in which we live. So let's get back to two of those major decisions of just this past term, those having to do with the capacity of the president to fire people in so-called agencies that are independent, so-called independent agencies as created by the United States Congress. We have talked a lot about this. There are two cases that seemingly go in different directions, as Amy Coney Barrett has very appropriately indicated. But we should also note that all of these cases, again, subject to further consideration down the road. A major expansion of the presidential authority, the Supreme Court cleared the way for the president to fire independent government regulators despite federal laws that were meant to protect their jobs. The justices at the same time carved out an exception for the Federal Reserve, preventing the president from immediately removing one governor, her name is Lisa Cook, as you well know, from the powerful central bank. The court's 6-3 ruling to broadly allow these firings, undeniably an incarnation of the unitary executive theory, the so-called liberal three justices dissenting, representing a huge change in the way that government works, a shift in power from Congress to the president, and could drastically change the federal government structure by giving the president more control over these independent agencies. The case involved a former FTC commissioner, Rebecca Kelly Slaughter. She was a Democratic member of the commission, and the president fired her simply because he did not align with her agenda. She did not align with his, despite a law that says that the president can remove commissioners only for efficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. The decision, however, has implications for many agencies, not just the FTC, including agencies like the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the National Labor Relations Board, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the Postal Service, and it ends nearly 90 years of precedent that protected those jobs. And so a huge consequence for the government and the way in which the president, not just this president, but future presidents as well, can have oversight and can, almost with impunity, fire members of these previously independent agencies, not based upon cause, but based upon political disagreement. In a separate decision, however, the court voted by a 5-4 vote to block the president, at least for now, from ousting Lisa Cook from the Federal Reserve. The ruling, sort of on a narrow procedural question, majority nonetheless saying that the uniquely independent nature of the central bank, the Federal Reserve, necessitated that result. We saw a lot of that in the oral argument itself. former Fed top agency heads and officials, others who know this well, who engage in this kind of work with the Federal Reserve, had warned that the Supreme Court, again in amicus briefs, that allowing this president, any president, to remove this particular board member while litigation is pending about her future would spur some economic turmoil, would undermine the longstanding autonomy of the central bank. And unlike other regulators, the president had accepted that a president can only fire Federal Reserve Board governors for cause. He had accused Lisa Cook, you may recall, of engaging in mortgage fraud and said that he could dismiss her on those grounds. The justices, however, unlike this case involving Kelly Slaughter, a very different kind of a situation, found that she had not been given the opportunity, that is Lisa Cook, to refute those allegations. And so we've got a process problem. The litigation as to that goes on. The Chief Justice writing there that the majority opinions in both cases, rejecting what he described as the administration's half-hearted contention that Lisa Cook had received a fair or due process procedure here, when the president simply noted on his Truth Social posting that he was removing her from that position. He's the Chief Justice saying that will not do. At a minimum, he said Cook was entitled to some explanation of the evidence at issue, some avenue for response. Now, Lisa Cook herself said the president's move to fire her was, according to her, an attempt to remove me on a manufactured pretext because I refused to bow to political pressure and continue to set interest rates based only on what would best serve the American people. The court's ruling, again, in her favor was limited. The justices plainly allowing her to remain on the job, unlike Kelly Slaughter, who is gone. She is no longer with the FTC. She can continue, Ms. Cook can, to contest removal as long as, again, these charges are somehow the product, the focus of some resolution, assessing, as the court said, the validity and the sufficiency of those charges. Huge decisions when it comes to the relationship between the presidency and these independent agencies. And again, the court making a distinction between these two seemingly incongruent decisions by distinguishing what it called the unique role of the Federal Reserve and other types of federal agencies. In those other cases, including the Slaughter case involving the FTC, majority saying that the president needed the flexibility, the ability, the capacity to remove officials whose views did not align with those of the administration's. In the FTC case, as we've talked about before, the justices did in fact set aside this 90-year precedent in a case that had prevented presidents going way back to FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, from removing independent agency regulators without cause and solely over policy disagreements. The justices, at least majority of them on the Supreme Court, had long doubted the continued validity of what's called, again, this Humphreys executor case, the case also involving the FTC. In that case, again, over 90 years ago, the Supreme Court had said that Franklin Delano Roosevelt could not remove a member of the FTC, again, as a violation of what Congress had done to establish the FTC as an independent agency. In Slaughter's case, also involving the FTC, the longstanding purpose in part of all of this, again, a part of this unitary executive theory, was to overturn Humphrey's executor. The Chief Justice said basically that to the extent that the ruling in Humphrey's executor was still in place, none of that existed anymore. And for that reason, specifically overruling that 90-year precedent in this modern era. The majority said that the modern FTC, again, had accumulated over time some powers that the Constitution reserved for the president under about 80 different statutes, including the enforcement of rules against private parties and the collection of billions of dollars in civil penalties. All kinds of things that have happened since the time of Humphrey's executor. The commission that Ms. Slaughter was appointed to unquestionably exercises, the Supreme Court said, executive power, and then according to the Chief Justice, therefore, must now be controlled by the Chief Executive, that according to the Chief Justice. And again, implicating all sorts of other agencies as well, making it unclear, for example, what happens with employment protections for civil servants out there, judges on courts that are inside the executive branches. Needless to say, on that case, the Slaughter case, Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Ketanji Brown Jackson and Elena Kagan, vigorous, strong dissents. Justice Sotomayor writing on behalf of the other two on her behalf, articulating this very, very strong dissent. She read a portion of it from the bench, which is not unprecedented. It happens with greater frequency, but emphasizing the extent to which this changes American government. She said in particular in her dissent that independent agencies, including the FTC, will now be transformed in ways that those who created them never could have expected and actively sought to avoid, fundamentally recalibrating, this is Sonia Sotomayor speaking, the balance of power in this country in this process. Again, she's joined by the other two, Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson. As a result of that court's decision, she said, this president, any president down the road, will have far greater power to do all kinds of things, including influencing independent agencies intended to be independent. They are charged plainly with many, many things in the operation of government, overseeing what can only be described as vast areas of American life, including things like the safety of workplaces and consumer products that you have in your home. Justice Sotomayor went on to say, it is a power, however, that neither the people, nor the Congress, nor the Constitution bestowed upon the presidency. She writes that in about 50 pages of dissent. She says, in granting the president this unbridled authority, the court upends its precedent. She's talking again about Humphrey's executor, misconstrues our own history, she says, and sheds any pretense of judicial modesty. That's all a part of the dissent. The plaintiff, the petitioner in that case, Ms. Slaughter, said independent agencies like the FTC created to be watchdogs, as they were, of potential corporations without interference by the president. Slaughter says this in response to an unfavorable ruling directed to her. She says, today's ruling makes it possible for presidents to fire watchdogs who won't put politics over principle and replace them, she said, with lapdogs. It's a recipe for corruption. Working families will pay the price. And again, as I indicated, this was not completely surprising, not only based upon the oral argument, but also suggesting that the Supreme Court, long anticipating doing just this, with respect to the FTC and other agencies as well. It is significant that in the course of her agreement or her dissent with respect to the other case involving Lisa Cook, that Amy Coney Barrett noted the inconsistency between these cases. She said that the case there, the Cook case, the Federal Reserve case, in that case, she said the decision to safeguard the Fed's independence was in serious tension with the court's ruling on the other agencies. And indeed, that will be the future here, determining all these other agencies, on which side do these fall? Is this Federal Reserve carve-out independent of all the other agencies only for the Federal Reserve? Are there things that the other agencies can identify that have so much integrity and so much importance with respect to the operation of those other agencies that they fall more in the line of the Cook case, as opposed to the Slaughter case? Amy Coney Barrett identifying the problem going forward, even as she dissents in the case And if the Supreme Court refuses to grant authority to the president, finding that he has the authority to fire Lisa Cook presently. Why is all of that important? Because it does effectively change government. It changes the ways in which executive authority can be exercised, not by just by this president, but by others down the road, and plainly invites future litigation. In future podcasts, we're going to explore that even more. We'll get back to Humphrey's executor and the amazing history that is now overturned in that case, and also talk about the history yet to be created in this particular area and in others. In our next podcast, again, we're going to visit some other 15, 16 other cases, including in our next podcast, these major decisions issued by the Supreme Court when it comes to guns in America. We'll talk about why those are important and why the promise of the Supreme Court to take on yet another gun case in its coming docket is equally important. All of that is coming up on our newly reincarnated, our newly reconstituted Amicus Law Review. I thank you so much for participating in and exploring with me what the Supreme Court has done, and in these coming weeks, doing more of that, and as always, responding to the important news of our days in the areas of civics and government and the operation of the rule of law in America. I thank you once again and look forward to being with you again every single week going forward here on the stations and the auspices and the platforms of Civic Media. Thank you, everybody.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
We're going to add on a special aspect of it for those of you who want some history and want some additional insight into this particular precedent that the Supreme Court overruled in the Slaughter case. Let's talk about Humphrey's executor, where that comes from, as a part of our continuing effort, Amicus, provide you with, in this case, history, some legal history, now also overruled by the United States Supreme Court. The court again, overruling a 90-year precedent in a case called Humphrey's Executor versus United States. How does this come about? Well, it turns out that a fellow named William Humphrey had been one of five commissioners of the Federal Trade Commission since his appointment in 1925 by President Calvin Coolidge. That appointment was re-upped in 1931 by President Herbert Hoover. And as an outspoken and fairly controversial commissioner, William Humphrey, was much in the public eye. And he had opposed most of the commission's antitrust enforcement actions and frequently engaged in some personal and political attacks in public speeches against those who opposed his views. He criticized the FTC's old policy of litigation against American companies, and he contended, among other things, that it made it the commission an instrument of oppression and disturbance and injury instead of a help to business. So that's his background. When FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, becomes president, of course, he puts together the New Deal. And many of the policies, practices, the initiatives of that New Deal run right up against what William Humphrey believes as a commissioner of the Federal Trade Commission. And so Roosevelt and Humphrey develop a strong dislike, a political dislike, but also an economic dislike for each other very soon. Humphrey is viewed by the president, FDR, as being an obstacle to the implementation of his New Deal agenda. And in his first months in office, he writes to Humphrey, that is, Roosevelt does, and asks him to resign. He says, "You will, I know, realize that I do not feel that your mind and my mind go along together on either the policies or the administering of the Federal Trade Commission. And frankly, I think it is best for the people of this country that I should have a full confidence." That's a diplomatic way, FDR saying, "I think you should go." Humphrey does not accept that. They go back and forth. More letters are written. And ultimately, FDR fires him, just as the current president fired Lisa Slaughter, again, 90 years later. And what happens in the interim is that Humphrey continues to show up for work. He shows up for five more months even though he's not getting paid, and the president and the FTC itself takes the position that he's no longer a commissioner. He continues to show up, and within 5 months, however, he dies. He is 71 years old, and purportedly he died of a stroke at the age of 71. And upon his dismissal, previous to that, 5 months earlier, the FTC, as I indicated, had stopped paying him because of the firing of him by FDR. He had a salary of about $10,000 per year. That's about $250,000 in today's money. And even though, again, he continued to come to work, he was not getting paid that. So when Humphrey's estate is being adjudicated, his executor, thus the name of the case, seeks from the federal government the amount of money that Humphrey would have gotten had he remained in that position and gotten paid for the 5 months between his supposed termination and his death. And he files a lawsuit in the Court of Claims of the United States court system, and he claims that Humphrey's firing had been unlawful, and the government therefore owed the estate the 5 months of back pay for the period before between his firing and his death. And it comes up to the Supreme Court ultimately, and the Supreme Court ultimately decides in favor of the estate and Humphrey's executor. May 27th, 1935, the Supreme Court issues a unanimous decision, 9-0, in favor of Humphrey's estate. And in an opinion, it's written by Justice George Sutherland, the court ruled that it was not a violation of the Constitution for the Federal Trade Commission to be empowered, be created by the Congress, and limiting the powers of the president to remove commissioners like Humphrey and presumably like Lisa, like Slaughter as well, and describing the only circumstances for removal as being inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. The court gives four main reasons for its ruling. Again, unanimous decision over 90 years ago now, said that the Congress had created the FTC in 1914, intending it to be a federal government agency, independent, nonpartisan, describes its mission as being one that should not be influenced by politics in any way, and supposed to be not in control of the president, and instead to be the operational force to decide all these issues related to trade and others. The court goes on to say, in its opinion, the commission is to be nonpartisan, and it must, from the very nature of its duties, act with entire impartiality, is charged with the enforcement of no policy except the policy of the law. The court also went on to say that Congress had intended the FTC to be experts in the area, business, industry, exercise trained judgment by a body of experts, and again, suggesting that that independence should be upheld inside the Federal Trade Commission. Other reasons that the function and duties of the FTC were neither political nor executive, but predominantly sort of judicial and even quasi-legislative. And it's on that basis, in part, that the Supreme Court, in this most recent case involving Rebecca Slaughter, overturns that decision and says now, 90 years later, much of what the FTC does is executive in nature. Therefore, the agency should be reviewed and subject to termination, its individual members, by the presidency. That's the history of all of this. That is no longer good law. Again, Humphrey's executor expressly overruled. A new precedent in place. We'll see how it goes for the future, not only of the Federal Trade Commission, where plainly the president can remove individuals who are in leadership spots, but also other agencies. How far does that go, and what does that mean as this important decision is implemented in the days, weeks, and months ahead?
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.